You're listening to the 10 Podcast, the discovery and design channel in health. Tune in with your host, Matt Patterson, to learn more about insights from the world of healthcare today.
Hi there, and good morning, and welcome to the podcast. I wanted to let you know about how you can access my personal time, one-to-one, working on your challenges. You might be an individual looking to move in your career and make the next step to success. You may be a corporate who wants to get perspective on different options for their projects before committing to any agency. Or you may be a startup who wants advice but can't afford complex, expensive consulting. You can benefit from myself and my teams and my networks over the years getting that access just simply straight to the point when you need it. There's a very simple way to book with me. Go to our website, www.weare10.co.uk, and set the capability to go straight in there, straight to my calendar, straight to a time when you can book with me. There's notes in there in relation to what to expect from the sessions to make the most of your time. I'll see you there. Now, let's get on with the main part of the show. Morning and welcome back to the podcast. What I wanted to do today, if you'll come with me on this journey, is reflect on what came out of the Great British Design Challenge sessions I ran. Where did it all begin? Found myself sitting at the kitchen table during lockdown, watching the Independent Sage Group, and the group of scientists that were led by Sir David King were clearly frustrated by the opacity of this group and the government's decision-making process, herd immunity and such the like. And they were using those sessions to set out the potential road ahead from a scientific perspective. And I thought this looked really, really interesting. But also at that time, I thought, well, the design and the creative community are not at the table, and they need to be in relation to discussing the future of Britain. So I thought we'd bring together the Great British Design Challenge to address some of these factors. And fascinating sessions they were. If you want to listen to any of those original recordings, you can listen to them all on our podcast series. You'll find them all on our website and all on our usual podcast providers. But I thought today I'd give a summary of the key factors that came out of that, the kind of findings that came out of it, and top 10 points, if you will. And that's what we're going to go through today. The team of people I curated together, for those of you who haven't heard the session, were quite a diverse mix. So they were the founder of Prospect Service Design, whose clients include Eurostar, Dimension Data and Vodafone, and Kluver, Charlie Drews and Martin Sadowski from Coast House Productions, content creators for the BBC, for AXA and for Netflix, where you'll find their work. Nico McDonald, founder of Spy, chief executive of the R&D Society and formerly digital design lead for The Guardian. Kate Hammer, innovation coach and educator for S&P 500 companies and Shield Collaborative, head of innovation and partnerships. Mark Hester, co-founder for The Imagination Factory, who helped the real-life Iron Man fly with a head-up display, and much, much more. Patrick Olszowski, who is as comfortable presenting at the Grenfell Tower Nursery as he is at Goldman Sachs. Kirsty Groves, founder and lead consultant at Shape Work Life, whose clients include Telefonica, Google, McLaren and Airbus. Focuses on work and design of spaces, and you may have seen a fascinating podcast we've had with Kirsty earlier on in the series. Will Knight, illustrator, draws fast for Google, Nestle, Smith & Nephew and the likes. Matt Hunter, co-founder of PlusX, chief executive of the Central Research Lab, ex-lead designer with IDEO and chief executive of the Design Council. Greg Boardman, founder of Three Stones Media, he produces and created Raster Mouse and Apple Tree House for BBC BBs. Claire Hester, digital lead at 3D Crowd, and Heather McQuaid, co-founder of Futuretonic, worked for a range of large global FTSE and S&P companies. So a really broad, diverse range of service designers, innovators, researchers, TV producers, creatives, writers, visualizers, and engineers came together to discuss where Britain was going moving forward. And what we set out to do was to try and understand healthcare, work, and play in relation to where could we move forward out of COVID that would be a better society. I've gone through all of those original podcasts and basically I've edited them down into 10 key area points. And so I'm going to discuss those points today and we'll work through some of those findings. Point number one, unequal Britain or inequality Britain. We're all in the same storm, but we're not in the same boat. We're not all in the same boat. From Associate Professor Alex Holmes, psychiatrist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. During the lockdown, Kate Hammer has been heavily involved in the orchestration of PPE. And one of the things Kate said in the sessions was, we don't actually have a very good language to describe countries like this one, where because of growing inequality and because of increasing poverty, we're dangerously susceptible to infectious diseases. She goes on to say that there are also hierarchies within the medical arena too. Feels to me like a jungle pecking order, so you get the great PPE when it's totally needed, but there's new data from a preprint, so it hasn't been peer-reviewed. A study of four major Birmingham hospitals has looked at the molecular PCR presence of COVID in medical staff. The lowest rates of infection are seen in ICU doctors, and the highest rates of infection amongst medics are seen in acute medicine, with even where PPE is less than the norm, and higher still is in housekeeping. Now, she doesn't know the demography of that job, but she pretty much guarantees there are going to be people of colour. There's black and brown bodies doing that work as contractors, Kay says, not even staff. In episodes, earlier episodes of our side effects season, you may have tuned into the impact of COVID on the BAME community with the work of epidemiologist Dr. Shikta Das. Shikta's work in diabetes and BAME deaths in communities illustrates what a complex and multifaceted area it is. And her work is well worth looking into as we're working our way through to what society looks like for a range of British communities moving forward, not all with equal opportunities. But bias and inequality does not stop there. It runs deeper than that. For Mark Hester, the designer for the Imagination Factory, he's designed for the past 20 years and everything from medical devices for diabetes to train braking systems. He says, there's a lot of stuff coming to light now. Things like seatbelts in cars that have not been designed to be as safe for women as men and younger children as adults. Maybe we should start with that and the most sustainable way to do this from environmental, cultural, societal and profitable way before we even consider all the other design questions. Greg Boardman has had a distinguished career educating kids in the UK through shows for CBeebies, including Master Mouse and Apple Tree House. And if you've got young children, you know both those programs very well. His concerns for inequality spread deep into the education space. So some students, Greg says, some students are going to go a year without any decent nurturing, and they're likely to be the individuals that would benefit most from being in a classroom with a teacher, able to make contact and be with them. This is genuinely upsetting to see. In the long term, if there's going to be impact in relation to schooling and classes where physical distancing is not pragmatic, then there's going to be some dramatic design improvements to stop a whole generation of children falling into inequality for different reasons. And Kirsty Groves, work design specialist, goes on to say this is absolutely true in the world of work as well. And in terms of those younger people, or people who are new to work, it's the ability to be mentored, to have instant feedback and soak up the physical energy of work. That at the most basic level, just the body language and oxytocin that you get from being in the same space as people. People are going to be missing out on this. And we are now a day on. And now we're the day on from when 4th of July has been mentioned as the version of return to normal society in many different ways and shapes and forms. We're cutting back to a 1 meter social physical distancing rule. I don't like to call it social distancing because we're not in social distancing. So what will happen next? An inequality lens has been focused and sharpened, I think, through COVID-19. And across all the discussions, the requirement and a need for better balance has been paramount to the thinking of the participants. Point number two, the National Ill Health Service, as opposed to the National Health Service. I'm going to read you a piece from what Mark Hester said in relation to considering the health service. Mark says, we have something called a National Health Service, which was set up with all the right intentions. And in the moment we're in now, we recognize how important it is more than ever before. But in reality, it's not a National Health Service, it's a National Ill Health Service. Because we engage with it at the point when we're sick. We actually engage with it when the point when we're injured. And maybe the sustainability angle on health is actually to look at a wholesale shift on all the strategies behind the National Health Service to make it genuinely about national health. So I think that what I've seen in terms of healthcare sustainability is a general relook, this is Mark, across the whole level of a wholesale sort of shake-up as to how we re-envisage this thing as a genuine national health service for the whole country. Mark carries on to say that something he's been looking at and thinking deeply about is sleep, and the fact that 10 years ago the World Health Organization declared the lack of sleep worldwide as a pandemic, and yet there's no evidence to suggest that societies or people in general have done anything about this. And he thinks this has real implications in relation to how we perceive health and how we perceive healthcare. Why do healthcare workers, doctors primarily, work 12-hour shifts? Mark goes on to say, I believe it comes from a guy who wrote an original training manual and date and training books a long, long time ago. He was absolute advocate of putting in all the hours, 12-hour shift. He was energetic, energetic, energetic. And that's what he believed people should do. After all his training methods were adopted across the whole health service, it was discovered that he was a cocaine addict. If you went to a garage and you asked someone to fix your car and they said how long you've been working and they said 12 hours, you'd go to the next garage. Epidemiologists have utilized the impact of non-pharmaceutical interventions such as social distancing, physical distancing, hand washing and the like, and they're all too ingrained in our expectations and understanding of life now. But little or no mention has been applied to diet or fitness, to rest or stress removal, and to sleep, as Mark highlights. Can we do more under this? How do we create a national health service as opposed to a national ill health service? Can we do more in society, Mark asked, to make us more resilient against the things that make us unwell, including COVID-19, if you listen into and have empathy for Dr. Asim Malhotra's consideration on obesity risks, diet, obesity, and resilience against metabolic risks in relation to managing COVID-19. The national ill health service. The national ill health service conversation naturally, considering body, moved to mind, with mental health being a core component as to how we act moving forward. Matt Hunter now is the co-founder of PlusX, who are creating contemporary next generation work environments, I guess, is how I would see them. Matt says on his spaces that they're developing, we're running our physical hubs to the WELL 2.0 standard, which is a Californian standard around air quality, light provision to the physical health and nutrition, etc. And ultimately, the perspective we had in it is that it's an incredibly important thing. Some people might imagine it to be a bit fringe, but actually it's pretty important. And when you go to employers, they say, yes, this is absolutely what we want. Big, large-scale tech companies like Google, like Microsoft, like Apple, provide a very different working environment to people to give them the flexibility to work with protection. And often that's harder for small businesses to manage, Matt goes on to say. The question is for us how easy it is for small businesses to access this kind of stuff. I think some people join big corporations because they recognize that the employee benefits are there. They're so much better. There's a gym, there's a canteen, there's all this kind of stuff. The problem with this being a small business is sometimes you don't have that kind of HR infrastructure. So one of the things we can do as a place where small businesses can congregate is to provide that kind of framework. All of Matt's staff are mental health first aid trained. We make it really easy for our resident businesses, even 5-person team, to have some of the qualities you might find at a Microsoft. Mental health and work are intrinsically linked, and as we go on to talk about the return to work, they are critical components that need to be discussed. Kate Hammer talks about mental health and agency. If we're talking about people taking the ability to take control of their lives and empower them to live healthier, you can't talk about physical health without talking about mental health. Claire Hester at the 3D Crowd has seen the shift of a system go from when the company had just 5 or 6 or 7 people into 7,000 volunteers or 8,000 volunteers. And now she's covered on Click on the BBC Technology Mainstream programme. Claire tells us that some hubs might have a Zoom social once a week and you might go on to do anything, but you read, but what's going on? And so some hubs might have a Zoom social once a week and you might not go to anything else. You read what's going on Slack and you deliver your products. Remember, they're 3D printers making visors, effectively PPE for the world. And you might never meet people in person. Other people have a very active profile on Slack, posting silly videos, chats, comments, just how people interact, to tell you about what they're doing and connecting. On a larger scale, every night they have had a regional meeting of the whole UK contributing, so Wales can find out what's going on in London. There are also times when the crowd outmanage through awkward moments. Part of it has been this self-managing piece in relation to people working in isolation at home. Claire says, part of it is also just people have a bad way, they have a bad way of communicating in text. So come across as potentially being rude when other volunteers are just getting quite cross and grumpy with each other. If you're dealing with text messages all the time, people have no idea what's going on behind these messages. And there's some miscommunications that can spiral. But as a whole, the crowd interactions, you never experienced this anywhere before. In the workplace, sometimes wouldn't do. They're not afraid to step in and say, hey, it's not okay to talk to somebody that way. And from a mental health point of view, it's an amazing way of experiencing group support without looking for it. People stepping in and helping when on digital. Mental health issues can be dealt with in many, many different ways. A national health service or a national ill health service at present, and as exposed in COVID, perhaps hasn't provided for this new normal. And the new normal will change working practices, and those working practices will need different support systems, especially if people are away from the office. Returning to work also has, no matter what happens, we will have to go back to work in some form. We come back into the real world. Despite the huge impact of the lockdown, I wanted to explore the return to work with our experts, many of whom are directly involved in its delivery. I started out by asking the group, is it a simple fix or the impossible jigsaw? Kirsty says, I think it's really, really a provocative question because it really depends on the position of the organisation. And I think it's going to be very, very hard for many organisations to really unpick, not just returning to the office, but really figure out what they want the future to be. Because I think there are two ways you can look at it. One is how we get back to the office as quickly as possible, following all the government guidelines so that we can try to make everything like it was before, which is going to be very difficult. Or two, actually, here's an opportunity. We're going to be living through a crisis, and we have shown through history to set the crisis like this, set the stage for a change. What do we want that change to be? Heather from the Future Tonic has two thoughts. One is more of a question, because some of the organizations that she works with are very hierarchical and kind of formal organizations. And she thinks that she's been seeing, not just with them, but with other organizations, more of a leveling of the playing field. People feeling more connected in a way to their teammates, their bosses and stuff, because you've been seeing them at home dealing with their toddler. Makes them a bit more human. And I think one question for Heather is that what's the effect of this when they go back into the office? Is it going to remain, or will it just go back to the way they were? Another thing is being thrown out there and working from home in this home hub digital proposition is the concept of Zoom fatigue. In trying to connect with people and keeping things going, it's like for one of her clients, basically had loads of meetings before, but now they've got meetings the entire day, and the fatigue from that is very obvious. With these pandemics, if they roll forward, we have to understand what a new working day looks like. For Greg at Three Stones Media, Greg says, I think that when we look at the areas that he works in, which is live performance education, making live action television shows, he has to go back to work. Whether it's safe or not, that's another issue. But basically, people are going to go out of business, and those businesses are going to disappear if you can't go back to making television in a live manner. There's a lot of talk about them going back, but there's no insurance cover for television at the moment. And television is very reliant on insurance cover to make things happen, as with film. So basically, it's not happening. And there's also a concern that broadcasters are not commissioning. They can develop things, but they're not necessarily any kind of pipelines or funds coming, so they can develop it on and plan for education programs next year, and they don't get a paper and they get theoretical support. But if their schools don't go back in September, nothing will happen. So there are so many components of the jigsaw that need to fit in with each other for society to move forward effectively. How do we have resilience in relation to returning to work? As we've discussed, whether you're an R&D company where you have to be in a lab, whether you're a knowledge worker company where you can work from home, or a digital company where you're home, or if you're working in a meatpacker's warehouse, which we can see already is a high COVID risk of where in Germany the virus has returned. There's so many different job design considerations that are critical in relation to this working well 2.0 that we have to design moving forward. How might we prepare blueprints that enable us to do that more effectively? Number 5, community service, or just serving communities. Really struck me in the conversation, this was run particularly by Claire Hester, about 3D Crowd and what a benefit community service and volunteering had been. Will Knight had said he was really interested in the ownership of time and who owns our time moving forward. We've just talked about return to work. But he says, where historically time is owned by my boss, who's the person that pays my money, I'd love to see whether there's a potential for better control that. I mean, already our sense of ownership and the way we're using time through COVID individually going through the crisis is very different. Clearly, many people are now getting used to time being broken and shifted and used in different ways. What if actually the state owns some of our time? Greg jumps in. Well, you've just touched on something that's very dear to my heart, which is a very controversial notion that he's been trying to propagate, which is, it comes back to the idea of state-owned time, where I believe a non-military national service would be compulsory. And this would be potentially very beneficial to all in society. The conversation goes down the line of exploring. Actually, 750,000 people were willing to support the NHS at the start of COVID. Might we have put them to a better use? Might we still put those volunteers to a better use? Claire said, I was going to mention the Good Samaritan. The response to that was overwhelming. And even if you just look at the 8,000 people signing up for 3D Crowd, we give community service as a punishment in the UK at the present time. But community service is a gift. It's actually a gift. If we're building resilience in our society, how may we revisit the use of time? How may we revisit the use of community service and volunteering? Number 5. Number 6. The commitment to a constant growth market around the world. Mark Hester says, the way I would sum it up is, and it sort of made me think again, about the economic system that we have in most part of the world, which is based on this concept of constant growth that then has an impact in terms of what we eat, what we breathe, how we work, how we play, and how we rest. This constant growth model behind everything that drives all these things that we seem to be realizing makes us feel vulnerable, be vulnerable to certain pandemics and the effects of certain things. When the pandemic causes us to be locked down, the air quality improves. And air quality scientists, for the first time ever, have been able to do massive experiments and see exactly what the impact of what we're breathing has on us. We've realized that the metabolic effects on how someone's body responds to the virus, and people are realizing how work can be completely different. So I guess the challenge to the design community from Mark is, if you look at that as a system, how do we design a better one? Do we start with challenging the constant growth model, or do we work on the end, you know, how we sleep better, how we eat better, how we work better? Number 7, surveillance and technology. With the government telling us that track and trace will be the lifeline to virus control, I wanted to explore this and start with the question of saying, what is an acceptable level of tracking and tracing and surveillance? And it kicked off quite a conversation. Heather said, from Futuretonic, first off, let's have a consideration of the trust index. This, the details about what organizations people trust. And they also ask who you trust in giving your private information and things like that to. And surprisingly, before COVID-19, people said they trusted private companies more than governments. Kirsty picked up this point. I think we're going to see more and more blurring of these boundaries. We already have done. And I think that it's really a heavily ethical question. I think when you look at the way things like the crisis have spurred innovation and actually allow people to drop their guard or open up the acceptance of a level of giving over some of their private information or privacy, that usually people are quite good at doing this kind of thing when they know we're in this, there's a purpose for it, and it feels like kind of contained amount of time, such as this pandemic. I'm happy with that. Maybe they've this quote, I'm very happy to tell an app how I'm feeling today, whether I've got a temperature, where I am. I'm very happy. I'd be very happy to do it for a period of time. But it's when that information becomes permanent. Well, what happens then? We've had examples of government surveillance after 9/11 that kind of went up in the States like nothing else. We kind of forget that. We gave away a lot of permissions to be able to use that kind of information. So my plea, Kirsty's plea, is let's be really careful, because it's not just work. It's our entire life. So who benefits from this data, Greg questions. I think one of the most troubling things for me is that the companies that stand to benefit most are the data companies that will or would delight in us all staying at home for a long time. I think it's really kind of scary. And I don't know if you've read the work of Shoshana Zuboff with a book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. If you've read that, I think you'd think twice to signing up to a track and trace app. it's kind of how people succumb to the data giveaway now, not thinking about what is being used for in the book and about how data gets used then to manipulate you in the future. And what I think the most troubling thing is probably what people are signing up to stuff for an app or signing up to a service or signing up to a bit of software. Probably don't realize how that information is then being used to predict your behavior and sell you something that you probably don't need, but predictably you might want something that actually you don't need. Matt Hunter's been working in this field from working with IDEO in California in the early 2000s. There's a deep understanding of tech-related innovations that extend into policy when working in as the chief executive of the Design Council. So what did Matt have to say about the age of surveillance capitalism and Zuboff's work? I think she's trying to be able to wake up policymakers. The thing is, I feel that the world of data privacy and security has been going on for a long time, far before GDPR. I think this generally happening that consumers are mostly ignorant to this, even when told. It is policymakers and people and think tanks who've got a sort of familiarity with the social harms that could be wrought, being ruled invisibly, insidiously. They're saying, actually, it's got to be done legislatively. The interesting question is, okay, this is undeniably happening. A few people like Shoshana says the work is going on, but the question is, who's going to do what about it? I think maybe, especially to the point of Kirsty's, who's making a case, especially in the crisis, the citizens may well, you know, dig for victory, give up your data for victory. But even after the crisis, I wonder, this is Matt, I wonder, and I think it probably comes down to the policymakers such as the European Union and others to protect the public good. We cannot spot it by individuals very easily because it's so insidious. Shoshana, according to Greg, argues that the thinking on the tech side will always be ahead of the legislators because the legislators are working on the big shock horror at the moment when in fact the tech companies are already ahead of them. Is track and trace, is it opening more schisms in society? Claire asks, how have we got a diverse range of people that are feeding into the cultural influences and had to stop or to have uptake in relation to a track and trace app? What do you do with it? How do we educate people about what they're doing and getting involved with it in terms of the grassroots system? Is it even the best way to do this, Matt? Challenges in relation to considering NHS X versus the call centre. It's really important because it's fascinating to see what's been going on in relation to track and trace. I think it's been tried and tested in lo-fi. It's a sort of human-to-human telephone-driven process been going on since the likes of tuberculosis. Tried and tested lo-fi, a highly accessible version, and then the tech companies may say, or wider points about bringing in tech companies by the work of Zuboff's perspectives. Tech companies are coming and saying, no, there's a better way, and it's digital. Actually, you might find that digital way may not be the best way either in terms of data ethics or accessibility. And he finds it really interesting that as an innovator, someone who's always been part of the mostly tech-driven world, thinks that when things are very complicated, sometimes the older tried, tested solutions which have been battle-hardened actually prove themselves in a moment like this. NHSX needed incredibly quickly to get an app out. Matt feels very mixed about it. I'm really impressed by what they do. I think they're amazing bunch of people, but it also shows how hard it is to make truly robust solutions. What do you feel about surveillance technology? What do you think about when you download the app, when you accept the track and trace, when if they need you to leave your name and address when you go into the pub in 2 weeks' time, or etc.? What is your view on this in relation to the discussion that we've just had based on the experts in the room? I think it's an interesting one. Number 7, Mother Nature, resilience in society. There's a new danger in the forest, Greg Boardman tells us. Last year, we were all about climate change and COVID has come along and we're not talking about climate change anymore. We seem to have sacrificed that for COVID, and the thing we sacrifice for COVID that we won't make for climate change, when in fact, it's actually climate change that is probably the far scarier thing. What do we do in relation to the bigger system to consider climate change, Mother Nature, and resilience? And where does that fit in with all of the discussions above, from inequality in Britain and obviously around the world, from a national ill health service to a national health service, from a well 2.0 way of returning to work, from the kind of accelerated pace, the going, the not slowing, and the constant growth model versus perhaps a neutral balance economy? What do you think? Aging and social care. It's been clear during the COVID crisis that their social care sector, from my point of view, were very much the poor relatives in the healthcare space. Nico McDonald's has been working and was pre-COVID working about the future of how technology can help in relation to the care environment. And when we discussed what this meant, it was fascinating to see where that space is going. Nico had been looking at the kind of things more humanely to support people in social care, next of kin, people running social care facilities and that kind of stuff. Looking at things from robotics for devices and sensing, with all the caveats that are appropriate to the basic things like communication between loved ones and information updates to those caring for people, music for people in dementia care. Nico references that there has been a government white paper, well, a green paper on social care, which has been in the wings for a year and a half now. It's clearly an area that's going to be addressed by the government in some way. The consensus seems that bringing social care and healthcare more closely together is the way to go. But to be honest, he wishes that things had happened faster because people have been not being able to see their loved ones in social care and much worse, you know, seeing people dying without seeing their families. Patrick has a history of lobbying around social care in Parliament. He goes on to say, unfortunately, social care in England, because it's a devolved matter, has been one of the policy subjects that's been kicked down the road for more than a decade, probably two decades. Who funds adult social care in later life, etc. Will talks with Greg around the community service component of perhaps giving up a day of your working week. Give a Friday was Will's concept, where perhaps that is used for more community-focused, maybe even care-focused delivery to strengthen and bond society. I, 5 or 6 years ago now, tried to launch a startup called Good Care Days, looking at trying to alter the dynamics of care delivery, hyper-local care delivery, but then it's very difficult. How do we deal with caring moving forwards? And how do we create business models that make them desirable, feasible, and viable at the same time? Because critically, in the end, it is something that has to be paid for and funded. The care model, as has been through COVID-19, has, it felt from our discussion, been something that has suffered quite heavily. What do we do about the care model? 10. Well, we don't have a 10th. Maybe we leave that to you. What is the 10th factor? I'll run through 1 to 9 again. 1, unequal Britain or inequality Britain. How do we balance society for all groups? Black Lives Matters, Black Lives Matter. There's clearly, in recent weeks, sharpened our focus on inequality, but that is just a component of inequality. What do we do to have a more balanced society? 2, the National Ill Health Service. How do we build a health service that focuses and has the skill sets to deliver on health, not just disease, but ease? Should we be focusing on that for resilience or not? 3, working well, Well 2.0, and the consideration of mental health in relation to the extension of the National Ill Health Service, but return to work. 5, I think that's 4. 5, community service and serving communities. 6, growth, the constant growth model, or perhaps a neutral balance style economy. 7, Mother Nature and resilience in society. 8, technology and surveillance. And last but not least, 9, aging and social care. These were what we got to as a group after filtering down 4 hours worth of conversations. I've covered a perspective today, and I hope it's been useful to go over those different factors. But you can see that they all intermingle, all intertwine, all work with one another, that you can't have one without the other. They're essential to consider as a suite of jigsaw pieces. I would like us to think of how we would work with those jigsaw pieces. Across groups, we summed up in a kind of way, like we always do with the magic wand. And the magic wand questions led to people having things that were looking towards designing for a more meaningful tomorrow. Of course, factors had to be desirable, feasible, and viable. And as designers, we'll described how we were designing with an ethical machete. We're explorers to begin with, and we don't know the answer. We're not upon pedestals telling people what to do. We're sort of hacking our way through the undergrowth, trying to find a path with an ethical machete. It is a big jigsaw. It's not a quick fix, but it feels like the bigger picture of the whole jigsaw has just been thrown up in the air. And actually, that's an opportunity. How, in terms of preparedness, will we be prepared for the next shock, the next wave, or the next pandemic? We've talked about the climate. We've talked about digital. We also discussed how scientists perhaps were better prepared to share internationally, and your reference in terms of how do we learn from cross cultures around the world, what has worked well and what hasn't worked well. We haven't got the platforms to do that. The World Health Organization, the CDC, those organizations have been better prepared over this period of time. How might we create a platform and learn off the practices from all over the world, small societies, large societies, to get best practice? What can we do as a design community to be better at that? Nico says, reminds us, we're not all experts in everything at every one time. At this time, everyone comes out as, I'm an epidemiologist or a statistical expert, etc. And it's often better to remember that you don't know when you don't know, and to ask and to stay curious and to have critical thinking at all times. Martin and Charlie, from a film perspective, reflected on a number of factors, from risk management and the work that was being done in relation to AXA, partially on their work of being a component in society to de-risk, to move from firefighting to mitigation. But also Martin focused, which I think was interesting, on this idea of a move towards a common good in our society. For many years, we pushed this idea of personal responsibility, big brands, companies giving us choice. The pandemic has thrown back a spotlight and the idea of a common good, old-fashioned concept. The governments can be big government and say, go inside and don't come out, and we'll happily do that. But if we buy into the ideas of common good, we're not thinking, what do I need to do for lifestyle choices for myself? I think there's some opt-in for Martin, some optimism, where we can adjust ourselves and thinking about the common good, not just this gold rush for choice. Should we have a focus on the common good? Is choice, endless choice, the nirvana? In my conclusions, I really noticed that there was a focus on care and on preparedness and on learning and on curiosity and on critical thinking and on challenging growth and on community and on enlightened leadership, referenced by all the participants, and on balance and on trust and on compassion. Across the group, there was no push. Now, remember, these are all people who've spent the last 20, 30, 40 years designing and creating services and systems and engineered processes and practices and products and businesses and policy for countries. There was so little push for products as the answer alone. What does that tell us about, as a design community, about what the society needs? You, as members of the designing community, what do you think? What do we need more of? What do we need less of? How might we better be in control of our time, our work, our voluntary work, our life, with better bias, with less bias, with more trust, with more bravery to tackle issues? How might we design better using global learnings of best practice in context? How might we care for each other better, whether we're young or old in society, in the street? How might we hold on to the practices of cleaner air, cleaner water, rethinking the constant growth model, allowing nature to thrive? There's so much more that I could talk about in this. But if I can conclude, for me, there are so many of these how might we challenges that I think bring a different kind of structure to the work that was being brought by the Independent Sage Group, or the Sage Group, about how we get through the here and now. And I'd love to know your responses about some of these things. Let's start these conversations and see what they trigger. How might Britain be better moving forward? Kirsty made a request at the end of the work and play session. Please make a video diary of the things you'd like the future you in 6 months' time to remember about your experience in COVID. That's been taken from a well-known building society. Thanks, Nationwide, by the way. What do you want to hold on to? And what do you want to change? Please make the video. If you're happy to, tweet it. Tweet it and tag us at We Are 10-2. We Are 10, number 2. So we can see it. And see the kind of things that you would want to be, to remind yourselves to do moving forward, 6 months' time from today. And that's it for today's podcast review of the Great British Design Challenge and the kind of key factors that I've taken out of it. I may have even got some of those numbering sessions wrong later on, where I numbered them 1 to 10. But yeah, the 10th spot was yours. What can you do? What should you do to make your part of Britain better moving forward? within your communities as individuals. Thank you very much and staying tuned in and following us on all the usual channels. Please do get in touch. hello@weare10.co.uk. Until next time on the podcast, take care of yourselves. Thank you. Goodbye. Hi there, thank you very much for listening in to our podcast series. I hope you're enjoying the episodes as much as I'm enjoying making them. I wanted to let you know about a product offer we have at 10, Insight on Demand. You bring the questions and we bring you the answers, getting together specialist top tier experts, just like you've heard in the episodes so far. The format is similar in many ways to a podcast. It's totally COVID secure. But this podcast is just for you. If you and your company are interested, then please do get in touch with me, Matt. hello@weare10.co.uk, and we'll tell you more about it.
You've been listening to the 10 podcast. Subscribe on your preferred podcast provider. Also, do let us know what you think of today's episode.